welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, August 4th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Rabble labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga sits down with Doug Allen, a researcher for the Canadian Union of Public Employees, or QP, to discuss the crisis in and surrounding Ontario's healthcare system. Doug Allen has been a researcher for QP for over 30 years. He also writes the blog Defend Public Healthcare. Here are Doug Allen and Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Take a listen.
Hey, Doug, thank you so much for joining us today on Rabble Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I guess just to start off, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your work?
Yeah, I'm a researcher with the Canadian Union of Public Employees. I specialize in healthcare. I've worked for QP for 30 years. I work with around home care issues and hospital issues, especially in Ontario.
You know, in the media, we've been talking a lot about the health human resource crisis, and the focus has mainly been on nurses and doctors, and their struggle is very real and very valid. But I was wondering if you could give us, you know, a bit of perspective on some of the other occupations that are affected by this human resource crisis.
Sure. Yeah, there has been a very significant human resource crisis in the hospitals. The number of job vacancies across all categories, but including the support staff, has increased very significantly, actually since 2015. Statistics Canada data indicates that since 2015, the number of job vacancies in hospitals has tripled over that time. That preceded COVID, but it did get worse during COVID. So we've got very high level of job vacancies in the service category, which would, you know, represent people like the porters, the housekeepers, the personal support workers, the registered practical nurses, the dietary workers, the maintenance workers. Job vacancies, according to the latest hospital data, is about 10.02%. So that's a very significant increase in the job vacancy rate. There is, of course, significant job vacancy rates for the RNs and for the paramedical workers in the hospitals, but it's of a similar order as that. The underlying story behind this is, despite COVID, there actually has not been a very significant increase in the level of staff in Ontario healthcare. When the present Ford government was elected in 2018, they promised, and they ran almost exclusively on this promise, to end hallway healthcare. A lot of patients can't get treated in actual regular beds just because there's such a capacity crunch in Ontario hospitals. But that hasn't coincided with any significant increase in the number of staff. So we're averaging about a 1.2% increase over the last 3 years. That's about 0.4% increase. It's a shockingly small increase considering the burden that COVID and long COVID have placed on healthcare. And it certainly doesn't do anything to address the hospital hallway crisis that we've been facing. The result is that now we have more patients being treated inpatients being treated in hallways than we did when the present government was elected. And then further below this whole level is that Ontario has particularly low level of staff compared to other provinces. There's sort of a dynamic in Ontario, in Canadian healthcare generally, where governments have a great incentive to remove patients from hospital care. So there's a very low number of inpatient beds in Canadian hospitals. So Canada is a bit of an outlier compared to other developed nations, a very low number of hospital beds that's been around for some time. But Ontario is an outlier in terms of Canada. We have an extremely low hospital capacity. And within that, we see, yes, there is a very significant thousands of fewer staff in Ontario on a per capita basis for inpatient services and nursing services. But we also know that there's about 8,000 fewer support service workers in Ontario hospitals than there would be if we were in one of the other provinces across Canada, about 8,000 lower in the capacity. And because of that, the whole system has problems actually delivering high quality care. Notably, key thing is for housekeeping, sometimes treat it like you were cleaning a bank, very much not the case. The patients in hospitals are susceptible to disease. There's a very significant problem with hospital-acquired infections, and cleaning of the rooms is a vital, vital part of that. But with the lack of hospital beds, there's a rush to turn those beds over, tremendous pressure to clean the rooms in a timely fashion, but not as indicated. We don't have the staff that we have in other provinces. Another way that this is reflected is through a degradation in the quality of the food that's served to patients. There used to be fresh food cooked in hospitals. That has really been changed over the years as cost-cutting measures took place. Instead of cooking the food fresh on-site, food is often shipped in over the highways from food factories in a chilled or frozen state. The quality is not great, and that is part of the story. We still do have some pretty good food in some of the smaller hospitals, but that's not so typical, and it's becoming more and more rare. It's a significant problem in the hospitals. Nutritious, fresh food is important within the hospitals, but it's particularly tragic within the long-term care sector, where the residents often may never get another fresh vegetable in their lives, just because the move to have ready prepared food and frozen food and to serve it in that manner is quite deep. And of course, there in a hospital, well, there is many patients who are required to stay for quite a long time and eat the food for a long time, or have the family or friends bring in other food. In long-term care, that is your residence for the rest of your life. So we have significant problems on the support staff side with just cutbacks, privatization, which doesn't lead to a focus on the quality of the cleaning and the quality of the food. Instead, the primary goal becomes profit making. So that's another significant issue, and of course, is being aided and abetted by the present provincial government.
So what's the health outcomes as a result of, you know, these pressures, these, you know, budget cuts and these staffing shortages? Like, what does that mean for patients?
The hospital system generally is in a constant crisis. I've been working on Ontario hospitals and their issues since 1992. More or less, and I have never seen the crisis that the staffing crisis and the capacity crisis that we have now. Hundreds of emergency room closures happening, backed up. This is primarily in smaller communities, but in some larger communities as well. Also, in the urban emergency rooms, just a tremendous backlog and delays of paramedics who can't leave their patients because their patients can't be admitted to the hospitals because there are no beds available. That's sort of where the crisis becomes the most noticeable, because the capacity of the hospital backs up into the emergency room. And that's often where the crisis, you know, sounds the loudest. You can't move the patients out of the emergency room because there's no capacity in the hospital to treat those patients. There's no staff, essentially. Sometimes that's represented as no beds. And the result is that, you know, we have this sort of unprecedented situation of closures and backups in emergency rooms and offload delays for the paramedics. So it reverberates throughout all parts of the hospital system. As for the support workers, they're the first target for the cost cutting. There's often actual directions that they be the first areas of the cuts. So, you know, we're going into the hospitals now, and many of them are just in very rough shape. They don't look good. It's not a pleasant place to be in. They're crowded. The floors are dirty. It's just not what we should expect of a hospital. And the result is that there are these problems with hospital-acquired infections. The estimates that we have is about 12,000 people per year die due to hospital-acquired infections. Part of that can be resolved by better cleaning in the hospitals, along with a number of other measures that have to be taken care of. And of course, having crappy food is just not good for anybody's health. And it's a pity that public hospitals don't model what good food and good cooking is. That should be the goal, in my view, of the public sector, that they should model a healthy eating and healthy food, not the terrible food that is now very widely recognized that exists in hospitals and other healthcare facilities. Not what we need to do. We need to model better food. We need to develop a system of local fresh food using local farms. But the model is very much the opposite. It's factory food. It's shipping in over the highway, sometimes over hundreds of miles. It's a significant issue, and you know, there is this crisis of violence in the hospitals. Very significant area there. You know, we hear maybe sometimes quite often about police complaining about the violence that's directed at them. And that, of course, is a problem. But even more is that there is violence directed against hospital workers. And that's in the nursing staff. That's in the support staff. In fact, the support staff are often the primary targets of violence. The situation in the hospitals, because there is this crisis in the hospitals, is one of great frustration. People are at their worst moment in their lives. Their families are in crisis. Sometimes they're not thinking clearly because of the illness. The inability to provide timely care creates problems. It just becomes very common for the workforce, the primarily female workforce, overwhelmingly female workforce in the hospitals, becomes target for that violence. Ending up in a headlock is not an unusual situation, unfortunately.
How can we, you know, address that and better protect staff in the hospitals?
We think that a big part of the answer for that is better staffing. It's much more difficult to attack staff if there are more staff around. The social dynamic changes. But also from the patients and the family perspective is that the frustration of not getting timely access to care can be diminished if there is more staff. We have the situation where there are tens of thousands of missing staff in Ontario hospitals, and that just plays out every day in frustration and in anger and violence in our hospitals. Hospitals are the worst workplace in terms of workers' compensation, lost time injuries as a result of assault or violence. That is a hidden problem. We hear about it in other sectors, such as the police sector, much more. We think that's a misperception of what is actually happening. And also part of the general assault on women in our society and violence against women in our society that we think should be a top priority for addressing it. It would provide a better experience and better care for the patients and their families, and also create a much safer work environment for the hospital workers.
I'm going to shift a little bit. So we've been talking a lot about the conditions in Ontario hospitals, and you mentioned it was 8,000. You said about missing around 8,000.
But 8,000. I can give you an exact number on that. If you compare on a per capita basis, Ontario would have, if we were like the rest of Canada, we would have another 8,131 support staff, as well as another 16,245 nursing and personal care staff in Ontario hospitals. Canada itself has low capacity, but Ontario is the outlier within Canada. And that's despite the fact that in some specialized areas that perhaps aren't typically thought of as always being done by hospitals, Ontario actually has a higher staffing level. So, for example, research and education, Ontario has more staff than the rest of the rest of Canada. That's fitting because we're a rich province and we are a densely populated province. So it sort of makes sense that those research and education facilities would be in Ontario. And then a little bit more peculiarly is that the hospitals in Ontario play a large, somewhat larger role in community health services than in other provinces. So that's interesting. But despite those two little areas, in the main core areas of what people think are hospitals, the inpatient services, the support services, the diagnostic services, the MRI, the medical imaging, the intensive care units, the emergency rooms, all of those areas are understaffed in Ontario hospitals relative to the rest of Canada. And we have seen no, despite all the talk about building new structures, we have seen only a tiny, tiny increase in staff. And that just does not deal with the increasing demands that we're facing, not just because of COVID, but for a whole range of reasons around population and aging, which is driving the need for a hospital and healthcare capacity that is just not being met. And frankly, I don't believe that the government has any intention to meet it. Their focus is on privatization. That is for this the hospital surgeries and for the less acute patients that they want to treat through transitional care facilities, which will be established, which are being established in places like for-profit retirement homes. That's their focus. But those areas are so niche, so small, that they won't actually be able to solve the capacity problems. And yet it's taking up so much of the government's agenda.
That's interesting. And so if there were the will to bring Ontario up to the national average, would that be enough to address the demand?
It would be a start, but no, I don't think it would be enough. I think, there, if you look at the capacity as measured by bed capacity in for inpatients, we are far short of say the OECD average, the average of the rich nations in the world, which Canada certainly is part of, and that is something that we have to consider. Why is it that we have this constant ongoing crisis of capacity, that's been existing in our hospitals? Well, you know, partly there is this dynamic that governments do try to lighten their load by reducing hospital capacity and sometimes creating, wishful thinking about ways in which the capacity crisis could be ended. But, what we need is we need a public that's informed and that tells the government that we need to build our hospital capacity, we need to build our home care capacity, we need to build our long-term care capacity to deal with the pressures that are growing on our healthcare system. This will not go on forever. Population growth and aging may not last. Well, aging definitely won't last, for more than once the baby boomers like me die off eventually. That push on the aging factor may not be as marked as it is right now. Population changes that we'll see where that happens. Right now, we're unlike a lot of other developed nations. We are seeing very significant population growth, but with that population growth also drives the need for more capacity. And Canada is a rich nation. Ontario is a even richer province. We can provide this service. There's no need to have a second class healthcare or hospital system. And yet, unfortunately, that is too often what we're seeing. The result that we're seeing, that we go into the hospitals, we see they're decaying in front of our eyes. That we can't get timely care. That the place is filthy. That it's in poor repair. All of these things are evident. But people have to say, community and labor have to just say that this is not what we want. We want a properly funded, proper hospital system that has adequate capacity.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in the words of the Ontario Federation of Labor, enough is enough, right?
100%, 100% enough is enough. And I think that does capture a way a lot of people are feeling, that we just sort of feel like the attitude of our ruling elites and our government is that you can't have nice things anymore. And that is just, it doesn't make sense. We are a richer society than we were. And yet the message told to us over and over again is that nice things just are not going to happen anymore, and you just have to put up with less. And I don't think that's it's not needed, and it's not acceptable. And in healthcare, where people want better healthcare, they want their that's a very vital thing for people, that they want to live, and they want to live a high quality life and a healthy life, and that requires proper and adequate healthcare. Not waiting and waiting and waiting.
Thank you so much again for joining us today and sharing all this valuable information.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you have a lovely day.
You too. Thank you.
That was Doug Allen, a researcher for the Canadian Union of Public Employees, and Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Doug. Switching gears now, here is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to catch us up on the top news stories of the week in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, in his final report for Rabble as national politics reporter, Stephen Wenzel reports that calls continue to grow to search a Winnipeg area landfill for the bodies of two murdered Indigenous women. Last Thursday, the Manitoba Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, Two-Spirit, and Gender Diverse People Implementation Committee called on all levels of government to implement disaster management protocols and begin an immediate search of the landfill. Instead of a search, the province has offered memory and healthcare support. However, this is not adequate or an appropriate substitute, said committee spokesperson Sandra Delaronde in a statement. Heather Stephenson's Manitoba government continues to reject any possibility of a search, citing complexity and cost. And as such, the movement around Search the Landfill has continued to grow louder and more heated. In labor news, Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga details the letter that working and retired public servants have sent to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, calling for the removal of Miranda Hubbs from the Public Sector Pension Investment Board. The letter cites concerns over conflicts between Hubbs's role on the board and her other role as a director for the fossil fuel company Imperial Oil. In February 2023, it was revealed that Imperial Oil's Kearl Mine facility near the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation had been leaking millions of liters of toxic wastewater into the environment. The letter to the Prime Minister reads, quote, "Ms. Hubbs's interests, actions, and obligations as a director of Imperial Oil are inconsistent with her fiduciary duty to invest in our best long-term interests and protect the reputation of the Public Sector Pension Investment Board." End quote. In other labor news, the labor dispute between the Iqaluit Housing Authority and the Nunavut Employees Union has stretched on for more than 130 days. The two sides had their first face-to-face negotiating session since March last week. However, after the meeting lasted only 2 hours, the union said that they felt the Housing Authority had no intention of reaching a fair deal. The union states that they are seeking better support for local workers, many of whom are Inuit, so they can better cope with the high expenses of living in the north. The union said that the Housing Authority's proposals during bargaining demonstrate their unwillingness to meet northern workers' needs. Meanwhile, the employer readily hires workers from the south and offers robust contracts that often include housing and allowances to match high inflation in Nunavut. In environmental news, national politics reporter Scott Martin reports that Canada now has a national adaptation strategy to tackle the effects of climate change. This comes after Canada saw the hottest week on record in July. Canada has been struggling with forest fires burning the most hectares of its land in its history. The smoke from the wildfires blanketed much of southern and eastern Ontario in early June, owing to over 100 fires in Quebec, 79 of which are still burning. But now, forest fires in the BC interior have contributed to deteriorating air quality and have also led to the evacuation of nearby communities like Pemberton and Goldbridge. Michael Bauer, a professor at the School of Population and Public Health at the University of British Columbia, told Rabble that Canada needed not only to adapt to climate change, but to make a concerted effort to mitigate it as well, saying, quote, "We need to do both, and there is hope that adaptation can also be directed to both address climate change, but also other long-standing health and health equity challenges like substandard housing." Finally, Rabble's 2022 annual report is out now. As you'll see in our report, 2022 represented a plethora of newsworthy moments for us here at Rabble to dive into. Canada crawled out of the COVID-19 pandemic, the alt-right occupied Ottawa in their so-called Freedom Convoy, the Commonwealth said goodbye to Queen Elizabeth II, inflation hit an all-time high, the Pope apologized, and Twitter got musked. For this and so much more, Rabble was there to keep you up to date on the stories that mattered to you. Visit our top coverage and insights from 2022 and our latest annual report today. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Finally, do you consume Rabble content on Instagram or Facebook? Due to the implementation of the Online News Act, or Bill C-18, rabble.ca may be disappearing from your feed any day now. But with a mission to bring independent not-for-profit stories to Canadians nationwide, we're not going anywhere. To continue seeing our content, please consider subscribing to our free weekly newsletter and bookmark rabble.ca on your browsers.
Rabble.ca shares news for the rest of us. We believe news for the rest of us is about creating a more informed and connected world. Help Rabble.ca make quality, progressive news and views accessible to all. Become a Rabble Rouser today and support us during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation.
That's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your campus, college, or community radio station? It's easy. To find out more information on how your local radio station can become a host for Rabble Radio, please email us at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to